Hi, and welcome to GP Skeptics Podcast 13. It's a podcast by GPs for GPs, and in this case, by and for nurses as well. It's wonderful to be back. It's been quite a long time since our last podcast, and I welcome with me my podcast wonderful co-host, Dr. Liz Sturgis. Liz, so what's been happening in your past year since we last recorded our last podcast?
Well, I've moved back from Canada, finished my PhD, and it's actually quite exciting. Our guest today grew up in Edmonton, where's the city I spent time in Canada. So nice link there.
Wow, they breed them smart in Edmonton. You've done your PhD, and I think our guest from Edmonton has also done hers. Liz, would you like to introduce Quinn Grundy?
It's fantastic to have Quinn with us. So Dr. Grundy is a registered nurse, and she's also a postdoctoral research assistant at the Charles Perkins Centre at the University of Sydney. And we're super lucky to have her with us today because she has her book coming out in October, and she's actually about to take up a position in the University of Toronto. So we're super lucky to get her before she travels home. So welcome, Quinn.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Delightful. So, Quinn, you and I have crossed paths on a few occasions, I think at a Cochrane symposium a few years ago, and I was doing some work on conflicts of interest and payments to doctors by pharmaceutical companies, and you wandered up to me and for the first time made me aware that there's also similar conflicts with the nursing profession, which I really hadn't thought about much. And a few years later, you've completed the PhD and had a book published on the subject. Fantastic.
Yeah, exciting. So the book is based on my PhD, which I did at the University of California in San Francisco, and really is the first in-depth study of the ways that nurses who do not prescribe interact with medically related industry in their day-to-day work and in the life of a hospital. And I had the extremely good fortune of getting recruited to Sydney, the University of Sydney, to work here with Professor Lisa Barrow and the Evidence, Policy, and Influence Collaborative, where we've been able to extend this work looking at the relationships between health professionals and industry more broadly.
Because I guess for most GPs, we would think, well, we're the ones who write the prescriptions or click on the printer these days. And nurses usually don't get that opportunity with just a few exceptions. So it's an unusual area of study to involve yourself in, Quinn.
So when I was starting my PhD, it was right around the time in the United States that they were bringing in the Affordable Care Act. And a piece of that was this Physician Payments Sunshine Act. So this movement has been happening globally, and Australia is actually one of the first countries to bring in some form of transparency regulation, which was back in 2007. But in the States, as you mentioned, Justin, the focus was really on physicians because they are prescribers. And this legislation passed, which required the manufacturers of drugs and devices that were covered under their Medicare to publicly disclose all payments over $10 in value to physicians. And at the time, I thought this was very interesting, but it made me ask a couple questions, one of which was, well, did nurses not have relationships with drug and device companies, or did policymakers not believe that they were important enough to warrant regulation? And as a practicing nurse at the time, I had heard anecdotally many stories from colleagues that nurses were attending drug dinners, nurses were serving as speakers, occasionally they were consultants. And so I sought to kind of investigate what that gap might be.
And your new book, which is titled Infiltrating Healthcare, How Marketing Works Underground to Influence Nurses. It's really great title, fantastic title, but it is quite a surprising area. Can you tell us a little bit about what you found?
So when I first approached hospital administrators seeking permission to interview their staff or shadow some of them in their practice, the overwhelming message I got was, oh, well, nurses really don't interact with industry. And speaking to a lot of people, the question always came up, well, if nurses don't prescribe, why would industry market to nurses? But when I went and talked to frontline staff, registered nurses at the bedside, nurse managers, nurse educators, clinical nurse specialists, the story couldn't have been more different. And they told me that they interacted heavily with industry, sometimes on a daily basis, and had been doing so for decades. But these relationships looked very different to perhaps the typical relationship between physicians and industry.
So, Quinn, could you tell us in broad categories, first of all, what sorts of interactions there are between nurses and pharmaceutical companies?
First of all, there is all the same relationships that you would typically expect physicians to have with industry. We see it in nursing. Nurses were going to sponsored drug dinners at steakhouses. Sales reps would bring a lunch to the break room and do a lunch and learn. They served on speakers bureaus for conditions like sepsis. They sometimes had their travel to conferences sponsored or attended sponsored events while at their annual conference. But then in the day-to-day setting of the hospital, there was really three main ways that they saw sales reps on a daily basis. So first were sales reps that were providing clinical or patient support in some capacity. This was typically in theater or a cardiac cath lab, where they were advising nurses on the use of equipment and supporting implants or other devices.
Because this was news to me when you mentioned it to me, that but possibly younger doctors know all about it. But I gather the reps are actually sitting scrubbed up in the operating theater at the time. Is that right?
So they don't scrub in because they are not meant to have any contact with the patient or the patient's confidential information. They are there to support the use of their device. And the muddy waters come in because they are also often working on commission for that device. So they would be there before a case to help the nurse select and set out their sterile kits. They'll be present during the case where an implant is used to advise the doctor on things like size, position, selection of tools. And they often mediate the relationship between the nurse and the surgeon in order to ensure the case can progress quickly and efficiently. But they also use that opportunity to form relationships, introduce products, introduce related products, and essentially to protect their market share.
Quinn, that's really interesting. I think I've seen a similar thing in hospitals in Australia around orthopedic devices. Is that the sort of device you're talking about?
So we see this quite commonly in orthopedics, cardiac cath labs, so stents, balloons, catheters, hips and knees would be. I think a lot of it has come out with the vaginal mesh cases where there were reps present or participating in training the health professionals around use of these devices.
I've spoken to a couple of surgeons since who suggest that these devices are fairly complex, so you know, artificial joints and that sort of thing, and you have to get it right. And they say sometimes they do really value the input of someone who knows the product very well in surgery, Quinn.
And I think that's certainly legitimate, and no patient would want their surgery to proceed without the necessary expertise. I think the problems come in that these sales reps wear two hats. They're both providing clinical support and they have a sales capacity. And so those incentives often are misaligned and it makes the decisions that take place not necessarily the most cost-effective or evidence-based.
Interesting. I think the same thing certainly applies around Australia with the teaching of the insertion of hormonal implants for contraception, the LARCs. And certainly when I went to my update, which is mandatory in order to be able to insert the LARCs, there was a rep there answering lots of questions. So we have the surgical aspects of things in theatre. What other interactions are there in the hospitals, Quinn?
Well, I think the second is what you've just alluded to, is the vast amount of sponsored education that takes place. And while we think that physicians or doctors, the prescribers, are perhaps the focus of marketing, industry is actually incredibly inclusive when it comes to sponsored events and sponsored education. So bedside nurses, for example, would encounter sales reps whenever the hospital purchased a new product or perhaps introduced a new drug on the formulary. And the hospital would contract with the company to provide that in-service education. But they would also form relationships with companies that way, and they might bring in a lunch and learn, other sponsored dinners, and work that we've done since my research that's in the book in Australia. We looked at transparency reports that Medicines Australia put out, and some of our work found that the pharmaceutical industry in Australia sponsors, I think, about 600 events a week for health professionals. And this data is a few years old now, but at that time, there was at least one nurse present at 40% of events. And a lot of these events are happening in clinical settings, whether it's journal clubs, ground rounds, lunches, in-services, and nurses are certainly a part of that education.
600 events a week. Liz, you and I are missing out on a lot of chicken sandwiches.
Too true, Justin. And I guess, Quinn, people might say, why does it matter? I mean, nurses aren't prescribing. It's important that we all maintain up-to-date information in our areas of work. Why does it matter that nurses are engaged with industry in this way?
That question comes up a lot. And when I talk to a lot of nurses, they also had internalized that question in some ways. And they said, you know, I go to these drug dinners, it's a nice night out, but since I don't prescribe, I don't really feel like it affects me. And I think drugs and devices are really interesting. They're different from other consumer goods because there are all these gatekeepers, these middlemen, if you will, between the patient, the consumer, and the industry that's marketing that product. And when you think about the life of a drug or a prescription, not only does the patient need to go to the doctor and have that prescription filled, but somebody dispenses that drug, somebody perhaps administers that drug, somebody perhaps checks in with that patient around side effects, medication adherence. And in the case of chronic disease, the pharmaceutical industry not only wants that prescription written, but wants that prescription refilled. And this is where nurses play a huge but largely invisible role, is in providing recommendations to prescribers, giving feedback on treatments, and supporting patients in taking their drugs. And I think industry gets that.
Hence the term underground in the title of your book. I guess what you're trying to do is unearth some of this stuff and make it see the light of day, Quinn?
Yeah, and I think from when I started the study and was told, you know, nurse-industry interactions, they really don't happen here, and then contrasted with what nurses were telling me. And they said, I've been doing this for years. Nobody ever taught me how. Some of them said, you know, I learned from my mother, who was a theater nurse, and she helped me learn how to set these boundaries. A lot of them, it was part of their jobs. If you're an infection control nurse, you'll be interfacing with reps from industry frequently, but it was never formally discussed. They had no preparation. And so they had to manage marketing and sales and maintain those boundaries very much on their own. And so part of this book is telling that story, is that this is a challenge that nurses face as patient advocates and in trying to uphold professional ethics and keep patients safe. But they're really doing it on their own, and the policy is not there to support them.
It's interesting that I hadn't thought of it much. Doctors don't think of it much, but you're also saying that nurses themselves often don't think of it. So it seems maybe the people in charge of the joint think it's not really happening, and the nurses, where it does happen on a daily basis, until you come along, haven't really thought about whether it's a good or bad thing.
Hospitals have tried to grapple with this. You know, many of them may have a policy that tries to prevent sales reps from cold calling or dropping in, but they still struggle because there may be a legitimate role for industry, for example, providing device support. But what we haven't been able to grapple with is this two hats that they wear. How do we get the support and the information we need without the sales? And so a lot of hospital administrators, they pointed to their policy. They said, you know, a rep can only come with an appointment and a badge. They have to check in. Or we only contracted for this one-off in-service when we introduced a new product. And what they don't see and what's happening really underground or under the radar is that the policies provide a legitimate role for these reps. And they get that badge, they enter the hospital, but there's nothing then to stop them from dropping in on the nurse managers or the surgeons by the sink or introducing related products when they're roaming ward to ward with their in-service. And these relationships grow over time so that nurses have their business card and can call when they need or they want to have a lunch and learn. And then you get to know these reps and they join the holiday party or the football team for the department and they become part of the family, part of the team. And so it becomes more difficult, I think, to set those boundaries and figure out when support stops and sales begin.
So the badge should really have a Trojan horse upon it.
Absolutely.
Relationships are really important in marketing a lot. And I think that looks like it's been really drawn out in your research as well. And so you've covered two areas there. So you have the within operations supporting people with device implantation and educational events. What was the third thing you found in your research?
So people are always asking the question, you know, why does marketing to nurses matter if they don't prescribe? But what is very much overlooked is nurses' role in purchasing all of the stuff that a hospital uses and what nurses are using in practice. So this really gets more so into the territory of medical devices. And a number of nurses I spoke to, particularly clinical nurse specialists, managers, educators, sat on hospital purchasing committees. And so they're not dealing with the big ticket items like implants or stents or capital equipment, but they're dealing with high volume, everything from bladder scanners to IV catheters to glucometers to wound care products. And so they would be tasked with selecting, evaluating, and then implementing these new products in a hospital. Also, when you think about areas like wound care, diabetes, nurses have a great deal of discretion over the products that they use in their nursing practice. And so this was an area where certain nurses, particularly when you speak of relationships, Liz, were targets for industry because of their decision-making role.
And that's really interesting too. We're moving more to team-based care, definitely in primary care. And with more doctors not seeing reps, sometimes we see the nurses engaging. And then when we have team-based case discussions, sometimes nurses can bring up their learnings from these industry events.
Yes, absolutely.
It's interesting because our practice, we haven't seen drug groups for many years now, and that was a doctor's decision, yet we still do have nurse reps come in. And so I was surprised. I sort of hardly knew it was going on. But in general practice, wound care is a big part of being a GP, and there's a lot of money flows through the practice. And look, I'm more than happy to let the nurses guide me on that because in all honesty, if you've ever seen a wound I've dressed compared to our nurses, I think you'd choose the nurse as well. But they are getting the information from the latest and greatest expensive gel or multi-layer wraps and all that sort of thing. And it's a big cost to the practice. And like most other things in my practice, we tend to go for the simple things that work well. But this is potentially an area where there can be something which is multiple times more expensive and theoretically might work a tiny bit better, but in the end, probably doesn't make all that much difference. So there's this push towards the latest and greatest and sexiest rather than the tried and true.
Absolutely. Wound care and these devices, it's a very challenging space because unlike drugs, the bar for evidence around efficacy or safety is much lower for these products to come to market. In most cases, they just have to prove that they're substantially similar to something that exists on the market. And so if nurses are trying to make, you know, critical evidence-based decisions around what is effective, safe, cost-effective, there aren't high quality trials, for example, and the research that exists is largely funded or conducted by the manufacturers of those trials. So it can be very challenging to find independent information in this space. But I think those efforts are not always there because of the convenience, the ease to have a nurse from the company come, deliver samples, let you try it, get hands-on. And certainly I think that is experienced as a great benefit. But as you've suggested, there might be considerable costs to the health system, the practice, and potentially to the patient as well.
Quinn, can I ask you, as a researcher, do you ever get pushback on this topic that you're talking about? Because I can imagine there's probably a few people in the world that aren't particularly happy you're looking and talking about this issue.
It remains a bit less controversial than the physicians, because I'm not sure that anyone still quite believes that nurses are key targets for marketing. And certainly compared to the influence of the pharmaceutical industry over medicine, the extent of the financial relationships, the ties, it doesn't look like that in nursing. And I think what I hear from nurses is, well, no one flew me to Hawaii and no one ever paid for my conference and I'm not getting a big consulting gig. And the overtures that industry makes to nurses certainly pale in comparison to the inducements provided physicians. And so I think sometimes the pushback I get is, well, why are you picking on us? We never get anything good anyway. You know, they brought Chinese takeaway to the break room. I didn't get invited to the steak dinner. But the conversation I want to provoke is that, you know, nurses remain the most trusted among the professions. And I think trust is easily lost. And this is something that, you know, increasingly will become an issue for nursing. And I think before we get to that point, we, as also a healthcare team and a healthcare system, need to think about the relationships at play with industry.
The nurses who are complaining about the low value of bribes probably need to hang around general practice a bit more, Quinn. I think our bribe levels have gone down markedly over the years. It's interesting. I certainly hope a lot of nurses listen to this podcast, and we'll try to push it out there among nurses, because it's a conversation that certainly hasn't happened. There's lots of arguments and pushback, things like, well, people need samples and, you know, it doesn't really influence me. I think to answer a lot of those questions, some of the evidence we collated back in 2014, there are about 20 of us who put together the campaign No Advertising Please. You can Google it, just Google No Advertising Please and you'll find it. And we tried to answer about the common 15 or so arguments for seeing drug reps. Of course, that was based around doctors seeing drug reps, but I think many of the same things could be used to provide evidence to argue against the nurses' protestations that it doesn't really matter or they're not influenced in any way.
Absolutely. It's a great resource.
Quinn, do you have any ideas about how to move forward in this area? What would you like to see happen between nurses and industry and improving things?
Well, I think first, Australia is ahead of the game in some ways in that the transparency reports are inclusive of all registered health professionals, which is not the case in the United States or other countries, for example. So I think the level of transparency here is higher. The transparency records could be more useful if they also included more types of relationships. So at the moment, they're restricted to individual payments for consulting, advisory boards, or sponsored travel. But what we're missing are things like meals, food, and smaller value payments that may be more common among nurses and other health professionals.
Quinn, as someone who sat through many hours of meetings to try to get that transparency code of conduct up, we argued heavily for what you argued, and the industry didn't agree with it. And eventually, the proposal they put in the code didn't have that included. But perhaps in future codes, we can hope.
One day. Nurses are there in 40% of the events. But when we switch to individual payments, the numbers are much, much smaller, because it's much less common that nurses would, you know, be consultants or sit on advisory boards. Though there's a few of them with some big payments. So much smaller numbers, but they are present. I think there's maybe like 3,000 to 5,000 payments to nurses.
Quinn, just remind us again where we can look up these payments. They are available on every individual pharmaceutical company's website, but that was about 40 of them. But something very good happened last year, I think, and they got palliated.
We call it the Evidence, Policy and Influence Collaborative, which is led by Professor Lisa Barrow, and we sit here at the Charles Perkins Centre at the University of Sydney. And we are in the process of publishing a number of these data sets. So Medicines Australia requires member companies to submit these reports, but as you say, they are published individually per company, per reporting period. So for some of these databases, we have collated hundreds of these separate files to create searchable, analyzable data sets, which are freely available to download and to search.
And I must put a shout out to a friend of mine who requires to remain anonymous at their request, who first decided that it was ridiculous that 2 years after the transparency database, the pharmaceutical industry still had not managed to put together a central collation for these. And so this person got out a spreadsheet, filled it all in, and handed it over to you guys for publication. So that was a wonderful thing that took one person a bit of spare time on their computer, which the industry seemed to not manage to do after 2 years.
And we are incredibly grateful and appreciate the extent of that effort more than others might imagine. So I think we're seeing dividends from this. Journalists have taken this up. Consumer groups are taking it up. And I think that's really what this data is for the public to understand the extent of these relationships.
Fantastic, Quinn. It's been so wonderful to hear about your book that's upcoming, Infiltrating Healthcare, How Marketing Works Underground to Influence Nurses. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been wonderful, Quinn. And of course, we will put all the various links from the things we've talked about, including Quinn's book, Rush Out and Buy Two Copies as soon as it comes out, on the website with the podcast. Thank you very much, Quinn Grundy.
Thank you.
So, Justin, did you see the latest article from John Ioannidis, the famous John Ioannidis?
I did, famous for his most cited article ever, that most results you read in medical journals are probably wrong. He's come up with a new, wonderfully disruptive article. What's it called, Liz?
It's The Professional Society Should Abstain from Authorship of Guidelines and Disease Definition Statements. That was in circulation just very recently. So, yeah, absolutely very disruptive.
He's one of those brave people, but it was wonderful. It was in a cardiology journal as well, because I think he gets a bit stuck into the cardiologists. My suspicion is that cardiology and psychiatry are probably the two professions where there's sort of most influence of pharmaceutical industry, to the point where many cardiologists and psychiatrists think it's bizarre that anyone would suggest that the influence could be negative. So I thought that was a brave thing, but the article has a fascinating premise.
Well, it's basically saying that because of their role in management of conditions and their potential to be influenced, that guidelines shouldn't be written by societies, so medical societies.
Yeah. Now, I mean, you and I have argued before on podcasts that guidelines are overwhelmingly too much influenced by pharmaceutical sponsorship. And I think there was a great PLOS One article by Ray Moynihan et al. Arguing that case quite successfully. I think Jenny Doust was on that too. And looking at the awfully high percentage of chairs of guideline committees and members of guideline committees for the various specialties that declared multiple conflicts of interest. And I think they averaged, you know, seven companies each, and there was something like, 70 or 80% in some cases. I think in some of the psychiatric ones, it was 100% of the people in the room had worked for multiple pharma companies. But this is a step beyond that, because this is arguing really that the experts in the room shouldn't necessarily even be from the specialty which the guidelines are covering. It's not an all or nothing phenomenon, but I think the argument is that the experts clearly need to be there for guidance and should be some of the members of the panel. But instead of asking the professional society to choose panelists and often with pharma influence as well, and then choose the chair and set up the whole thing and then publish the results, which of course then affect tens of millions or hundreds of millions of patients, the concept should be that there should be a more neutral group who collate the evidence, and that would include, I guess, experts in evidence-based medicine, and then people all get together. And the sorts of people you might include might be some of the people who are experts in that field. So, you know, cardiologists when it's cardiology guidelines, but then also you have experts in evidence-based medicine, you have experts in statistics, primary care physicians, like you'd be good on one of these panels, I think, Liz, and consumer representatives, so people who are going to be affected by these decisions, perhaps pharmacists. So you put all these people in the mix, look at the evidence and create the best possible guidelines.
It's interesting. It seems to be another example of where diversity in decision making might lead us to better places. Do you think this means our own College of GPs is doing something that Arnoitus wouldn't approve of?
That's a good question. I know a lot of GP panels and things do try to certainly include a consumer representative. But yeah, look, I guess that could be the case. The RACGP guidelines produced and comments on guidelines tend to be fairly small affairs with low budgets and a lot of, you know, semi-volunteer time on the part of the GPs who are on those panels. It would be somewhat difficult, I think, to attract too many specialists onto those panels, but certainly that is the case for some of them. Mm. But yeah, look, you're probably right. Maybe we should start in our own backyard.
Very interesting article. And you'll put the link up?
Yeah, we'll put the link on the website. And it's just, it's worth thinking about. I mean, it's like throwing a bit of a hand grenade into the room and seeing what happens. So I don't think there'd suddenly be a call for entirely independent guidelines being produced with no input at all from societies. But I think it's, you know, setting up the straw man argument and seeing who knocks it down. And you might find that there's some straw left over. Where you end up remains anyone's guess. I can't imagine that you'd end up with an entirely independent panel, but I think we should certainly be heading in that direction.
In some specialties, an independent panel would be a very small one indeed.
Indeed. Thank you, Liz. Let's move on now to Liz's special source. What have you got this week for us, Liz?
Thanks, Justin. Well, bouncing off our very successful and heaps of fun workshop at GP18 this year, I thought we could discuss a little bit more one of my favourite go-to for information, the therapeutic guidelines.
Ah, now at our GP18 workshop, we had the CEO of the therapeutic guidelines, Sue Phillips, was kind enough to record an interview, I think about 24 hours before we went to air. Thank goodness we were far too disorganized to have our PowerPoint in. And Sue gave a great rundown answering one of the particular questions we posed to her about whether gargles work for sore throats, which isn't something you would necessarily think would be in therapeutic guidelines, but they certainly had this tiny little question of symptomatic relief of sore throats as opposed to antibiotic use. They did, in fact, have evidence for it in the antibiotic guidelines. It's one of those small little things which appear hundreds of times throughout the therapeutic guidelines, and one of the reasons I find them so useful.
And Sue had some first breaking news there for us in that the antibiotic guidelines are currently being rewritten and I think are due for release in March of next year. So that was really exciting. And the thing that I learnt about therapeutic guidelines when I went having a look about, they're actually a not-for-profit company, which I had no idea that that was the case. And their mission is to improve the quality use of medicines around Australia. And they're completely independent. So they're independent of both government and commercial industry funding. So that's quite an achievement, really.
How do they pay their wages and pay poor old Sue? I assume as she's CEO, she doesn't do it on a volunteer basis. Where do they get their money from?
That I do not know, Justin, and I should have checked that out.
It's a subscription thing, so I get it currently for free at as a Queensland Health employee. So Queensland Health, I assume, pays a subscription to give all its workers the access to it. I don't know if there's any money coming in beyond the subscriptions.
If you have a look on their website, they say independence is an essential feature of the organisation. It's completely self-funded with all of its revenue from subscriptions and book sales. There's no grants, no advertising, no shareholders, no sponsors. That's pretty incredible.
That is fantastic. And the other thing that happens in groups like that inevitably is that there's not quite enough money to go around. So it really does rely upon a whole lot of people putting in a good effort, you know, whether they be clinicians or researchers, they probably get something for it. But I love those organisations where people just think it's a great idea and they want to go above and beyond that, what they would do if it was merely a paid job. The other thing I love about therapeutic guidelines is the rapidity of their search function, something I'm very keen on. You go to the opening page of all the guidelines and you just type in sore throat, and it may appear actually in more than one guideline. In this case, that only appears in the antibiotic guideline, but you can type in any symptom, which I think is very useful for GPs who are trying to get information on the spot and really don't want to spend more than 1 to 2 minutes flicking through something in front of the patient.
I use it a lot within a consultation. I've not really used it for symptoms before, so that's a good trick you've taught me today.
You probably have a clever enough to have like a bacterial diagnosis or something while I'm still floundering around trying to guess what might possibly be causing the symptom.
Oh, you're too kind.
I can never spell those bacteria anyway. So.
Chlamydia is one of the hardest words to spell, I think, in the world. It really is.
Yeah, second only to amitriptyline. No one ever gets that right.
So therapeutic guidelines, I've always been a fan, and now having discovered this about them, I'm like super fan.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Liz. I think after that great chat with Quinn, we're probably almost towards the end of this podcast, but I believe we possibly have one final segment. What might that be, Liz?
The one we always wait for, the What Would Justin Do segment. I'm going to go a little bit easier on you because I'm actually going to reuse the scenario we talked about a little bit at GP18 because we only had such a quick moment to talk because of time.
This is the first one on all these podcasts I've actually known about before you've asked me. So that's good. Happily,
you're very brave.
I've written 8 pages of notes and researched it heavily to sound far more erudite than I did on stage, except I can't quite remember the question. But as soon as you ask me again, it will no doubt spring to mind.
There you go. So it's almost like you don't know what I'm going to ask you again.
That's because I'm so vague.
That's right. So I wanted to explore with you, and we did a little bit already at GP18, but we can recap on what do you think about educational grants from industry. The first scenario I'd give you is one where industry has given money to an independent medical education company who then pays you to deliver education. And I'm just wondering, is that something that you would do, and what parameters you'd put around that for yourself?
Happily, I do remember that now, Liz. And I think after umming and ahhing a bit, I came up with the answer, yes, it is something I would do. So I can't really change my mind now. I, for example, write for GP newspapers and I edit a medical journal, and both of those certainly have pharmaceutical ads sponsoring them. My condition of editing the journal and writing the articles is that I don't want to know who is going to advertise or what they're going to advertise. I make sure no one tells me or informs me. And in fact, those decisions happen entirely independently. Now, I do know that, you know, by the time my words come on the page, there may well be some sort of ad next to it. The publisher says to me, you can write a column on whatever you want to write it on, and I just go ahead and write it. And I think in all my 20 plus years of writing, there's never been an occasion where anyone has substantially altered what I've written or told me I can't say that, or, you know, said this is going to be an insult to a sponsor or anything like that. So I
and
can
you have
say
said
that
quite a lot of insulting things over the years, haven't you?
I have. And things which, you know, people vehemently disagree with, and we have this this raging debate. The beauty is that the publishers have always sort of thought, well, that's good for their publication readership numbers, if I say anything which is controversial. So, and ditto for the journal I edit. So I guess to me, that degree of being hands-off is a sort of a practical one. Sure, I mean, if someone offered me a job editing a journal with no sponsorship whatsoever, that would be great too. But in this day of publishing, it's quite hard to do so. For me, I guess that level of independence, I think, is reasonable, and I draw a line below that level.
And do you have that in a contract?
No, I've always been a freelancer, and so I just get paid per article.
On dangerous verbal agreements, Justin.
Ooh. Yeah, well, the beauty is the worst they can do is not pay me for my latest article, and then I'll stop writing. So I'm only really risking one article's worth of payment, and it seems to have worked for a very, very long time. So I don't think that's a huge issue.
Great. Thank you for your fantastic answer, as always.
My pleasure. I felt I was almost putting my head through a noose there, but I think I slipped out of it at the last minute. Liz Sturgis, it has been a long time between podcasts. I think about a year between our podcast 12 and our podcast 13, but it's wonderful to get back into it again. This will be my last podcast as a Queenslander for some time. So I am heading off to a rather small island in the Northern Territory for the upcoming years. This will be my last one. So in that sense, I'm signing off from Brisbane. And the next time you hear me, I will be on Bathurst Island, one of the Tiwi Islands.
Fantastic. That's so exciting, Justin. I might have to come up there and visit so we can podcast from the same place. That would be great.
That would be an extraordinary thing. Liz, great to speak to you. Thanks for that, and I'll speak to you soon in the new year.
Take care.